Good morning, everybody. It is September 28th, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom, your home away from homeroom, certainly my home away from homeroom. I am your teacher in exile, your host, Frank, and we are here today to discuss the modernist turn in art. Yesterday, we started looking at this, and we defined it, I guess, to start. What is the modernist turn? Well, it is when art turned away from, or at least some artists and their audience and their market turned away from, the course that art had been following for centuries. Turned away from, for painting example, turned away from realistic representative art to abstract figurative art. Much the same occurred in sculpture. In painting, maybe you can say it was from the Hudson River School to someone chewing up a paintball and spitting it at a canvas. And poetry, it was when the poets abandoned rhyme and meter, beautiful sounds, to articulate sweet sounds together, as Yeats said in Adam's Curse in 1903. And instead, focus on the phrase rather than the meter, on the thing instead of the poetry. So yesterday, we talked about where this all came from. Painters and poets started it. Painters were terrified of photography. Poets were terrified of recorded music. They were threatened. They felt that they could not compete with this new technology. But of course, they still had these very human desires to excel in their arts and to achieve status in the eyes of their peers, to become rich, and to achieve immortality in through their art. So how could they do this when cameras were stealing and when recorded music was stealing what they had considered their territory, their domain? Well, the way they did it is they redefined their arts, and they said, oh, we're really not about beautiful sounds. We're about something else. We're really not about representing the world. We're about something else. And these poetry and painting did not fall because the rich came to them. The elites came to them and say, hey guys, let's create a new way to signal how rich we are. Let's create a new way to create status. No, it happened the other way around. The artists themselves sought out the rich. They were afraid, as I said, and then they sought out the rich. Harriet Monroe, we talked about yesterday, seeking donations from Chicago businessmen for her poetry journal in 1912. Now, today, I promised to talk about architecture. So let's do that. Architecture did indeed have a fall, just like the other arts. I say a fall because, obviously, I do not approve of modern art. We'll get to why it isn't even really art in the sense of being sold for its artistic qualities or being praised for its artistic qualities. We'll get to that in a second. But that year, 1912, is very important. The timing here is very important for understanding why we are where we are today. Let's think about architecture in that year, 1912. It's a famous year in architecture. The number one achievement of that year was a fantastic achievement, worthy of greatness in any age. Do you know? I bet you do. The Woolworth Building went up in 1912, right? And there is only one rule about the Woolworth Building, and that is you love it, right? You have to love it. Everyone loves it. It is the Michael Jackson of buildings. If you say you don't like the Woolworth Building, then you're really just fooling yourself, right? You just have to be. If you've never seen the Woolworth Building, it's down there in Tribeca in Manhattan, New York City. Go make a pilgrimage. The Cathedral of Commerce, they call it. And I live near it I live very close to it for 2 years, saw it nearly every day. Never got tired of seeing it. Gothic on the outside, modern in the good sense on the inside. Absolutely fantastic achievement of architecture. So, and everybody loves it, right? It's popular. It was also still praised by the elites within architecture. So even Frank Lloyd Wright, right, who normally decried all this ornament, and he didn't like the ornament on Woolworth Building, it's true, but even Frank Lloyd Wright found it in him to praise the lines and the contours and the shape of the Woolworth Building. So the point is that in 1912, this revolt, this catastrophic turn, had not taken place yet in architecture. It didn't come in America for another two decades, right? You had in the 1920s, the late 1920s, Chrysler Building and Empire State Building both going up. Fantastic examples of architecture. Again, especially the Chrysler Building. Everybody loves it. Art Deco style, people really like that. You can still see that style being imitated, that style being popular everywhere. I see it in Dover publications, catalogs all the time. They seem to be coming out with Art Deco stuff here, Art Deco stuff there. So the architecture turn didn't happen in America really until after the 1920s. Over in Europe, things were starting to change. You had Le Corbusier, the Great Crow, before that. And of course, his early architecture, 1900s, was anything but modern. And he had his parents' house, he had his Schwab house, which were really cool, really interesting things. And he developed his philosophy, right? His great statement, a house is a machine for living in. And people love machines, right? We have all kinds of gadgets. This sort of development, his early architecture was fantastic. But in 1918, he met the Cubist painter, Amédée Ozenfant. And after that, things started to suck in Europe for architecture. Note the point here. The point is that the infection is spreading, right? It started in painting, and you had Le Corbusier going through some really pretty good architecture, and then it spread. The infection spread. He met this Cubist painter, and his architecture went, what I would say, quite downhill. Now, how and why that spread happened, exactly what it was, we'll get to that in a minute. Right now, I'm just sort of establishing this timeline for you. 1918, Corbusier meets Cubist painter and says, oh yeah, let's make some buildings that are crappy. Or at least, you know, I'm using crappy in the sense that most people, according to the surveys that I was quoting yesterday, and according to my own taste, would consider crappy. So another example, Bauhaus school, right? This started in Germany right around 1919. This may be the worst architecture humanity has ever seen, and I mean that. I would rather live in a thatch hut. I think most people would rather live in a thatch hut. It's more beautiful. It's more comfortable. Sure, the roof leaks, but this is a small price to pay to avoid seeing what these guys produced. I have seen better structures on North Sentinel Island, right? This is not good. But it was started. Who founded it? Walter Gropius, right? And here's the thing. He couldn't draw. He never could draw. So more than other architects, he needed to pay attention to the world of painting, the world of graphic art. And he paid so much attention to that, that when, after World War I, Walter had the opportunity to take over an old art school. Ironically, it was named, I think, the Grand Duke's Arts and Crafts School, not to steal a phrase. And when Walter had the opportunity to take over the school and transform it, he transformed it into Bauhaus. And one of the first things on his list was to bring in painters. Whom did he bring in? Kandinsky and Klee. Oh my gosh. look at how telling this is, right? Kandinsky, by 1918, was in full-on modernist mode, just like a lot of the painters over in Europe. He had completely transformed from his earlier career, which was more representative. And now, by 1919, he's painting these full-on nonsensical visions, no form, no figure. He was 50 or over 50 by then. He had just married 17-year-old Nina a couple of years earlier, 1916, I think. And this was the influence that he brought to Walter's new architecture school. And then Klee, who was younger, influenced by Kandinsky, brought the same sort of modern aesthetics from his painting to this new architecture school. And so it came to pass. The infection spread from painting into architecture. And after another decade or so, it also made its way into America. The chief idea, of course, that these painters brought was that representative art needed to be avoided at any cost. Representation was child's play, according to these modernists. They had to move beyond child's play. Now, their motive, as I've said, really was fear, whether they acknowledged it or not publicly. They did not want the photograph to steal their chance of success, their chance at immortality. Now, that's what happened with architecture. An infection spread from painting. The same thing happened in music, guys. The same thing, right? It was infected by poetry. John Cage, he was deeply influenced, right, by Charles Olson, by James Joyce, both of whom had gone off the poetry deep end. Now, Joyce, you might not classify as a poet, certainly predominantly he was not, but his sort of nonsensical, streaming, spewing writing was an example of poetry going off the rails. And Charles Olson, of course, the same exact thing. Benjamin Britten, right? Deeply, probingly, you might say. I'm sorry, influenced by W.H. Auden. So you see the exact same thing here in music that you see in architecture. Namely, the ideas are spreading from painting into architecture, and then from poetry into music. Now, in his post that I'm responding to here, Scott Alexander, he focused on the rich and the elite class, and he seems to be almost tunnel visioned on what they could have done to cause this and how things revolved around them. Now, of course, they are important. They did play a big role, but this is a very key idea that the origins of this modern turn, the start of it, was not at the request or the behest of the rich and the elite. Rather, it was by the artists themselves. And then they were motivated to go to the elite and recruit the elite, not the other way around, right? And the rich did, the elite did play a role, continue to play a key role, and we'll explore that here. But it is important to understand the elite did not start this. So, what role did the elite play? The moneyed class, the status class? Well, they provided three things that I'm going to lay out for you here. The first is obvious. They provided money and funding. The second is almost as obvious. They provided an audience. The modernists needed an audience desperately. You cannot achieve the sort of immortality that they are looking for if there is not going to be an audience that is going to lionize you and sing, you know, paeans and hymns of praise to you, echoing down through the centuries. So they needed an audience. They panicked. They had abandoned their previous audience, leaving that previous audience to machines, to photography and canned music. So the rich and the elite class did provide that audience. The third thing is the most important. The third thing that the money class, the status class, was able to provide was sanction and status, validation. This symbiotic relationship developed where the artists helped the elite signal their status as elite, and the elite helped the artists signal their status as elite. They used money, they used their connections to do this. And this was able to succeed because now that they had closed, the artists had closed themselves off from the pressures of the popular market, they had transformed their product. It wasn't art anymore. It was simply a positional good. They had given up on selling their art as art to people who wanted art, and they had turned to this closed environment where they it wasn't the quality of their good, but the position of their good that had become important. And now all the usual rules surrounding positional goods came into play at this point. If you're not familiar with positional goods, think of it like the classic example, I guess, is fine wine. No one, except for the super tasters out there, and those are extremely rare, no one can tell the difference really between a $200 bottle of wine and a $10 bottle of wine. If you think you can, test yourself. You know, if you really can, then maybe you're one in a million. But most people can't. They like to pretend that they can. They like to say that they can, and it's fun for them. It gives them some value and it entertains them. And so that's great, to each his own. But it's not about the quality of the wine, it's about the position of the wine. Here's a quote about positional goods, and see, you can see how it applies to the art world as it was developing here at the early part of the 20th century. Positional goods are a subset of economic goods whose consumption and subsequent utility is also conditioned by Veblen-like pricing. This is where as price goes up, demand goes up. Depends negatively on consumption of those same goods by others. That last part is the key idea. It depends on the negative consumption of those goods by others. In other words, you need other people to not like your stuff, to make it exclusive. And that really helps explain why the art is bad, why it turns off the masses, why a lot of people don't like it. Because to be a positional good, you have to carve out a niche. You have to be exclusive. You have to be in this corner where you're not being consumed by many people. Now, it is generally also true that a positional good needs to be looked up to, needs to be desired, needs to be wanted by a lot of people who can't necessarily have it. So, how does that apply here? You know, a positional good, it's not consumed by a lot of people, but it is demanded by a lot of people. Well, if it's such bad art and the masses don't like this bad art, where does that piece come in? Where does that desirability come from? Well, it comes from the fact that some people are willing to pay $10 million for a Kandinsky or Klimt. They're willing to pay outrageous prices for these objects, and they're supporting the market that way. So the good is not desired for its art quality. I would love to have one of these modernist Rauschenberg, Pollock, paint splotch, whatever. I'd love to have it. Not because I think it's any good as art, but because I could sell it for a lot of money. And that's this genius of the symbiotic relationship that the artists and the elite class entered into here, is that they are propping each other up. The whole scheme would fall apart if you could sell a Kandinsky for $500. Nobody wants that. It has to be worth millions to give it that desirability piece, but that desirability doesn't come from its art. It comes from its status. It comes from its ability to signal. It comes from its ability to let you into this club. And that's why art that shows you how art became a positional good, and that's why we have the very high-end art market that we do. Almost by definition, positional goods demand high prices, or else they will go by the wayside. They're not just high prices, they're exclusive prices. And in the past, right, that would have been the end of the story. The arts were supported by the elites. You got the art that the elites, the moneyed class, supported. End of story. This technicolor vomit would have been the art of our age. Yes, wave a tiny flag for the 20th century, boys. Up against David, what are we putting? Well, maybe the Gates. How about that? I mean, that's just what we would have had, right? Remember the Gates in Central Park, those things? Oh, my gosh. I remember walking through those, staring at those, the tourists who come flocking in to seeing them, and I was thinking, what the heck, right? This is the same thing that happened to me. I was looking at Structure That Eats Salad one day at Guggenheim and just laughing at it, right? Literally laughing at it. Structure That Eats Salad, I think, by Anselmo, Giovanni Anselmo. And all the tourists are just staring at it, or who knows, maybe they're not all tourists. And I was just laughing because it's hilarious. I didn't even really laugh at the Gates, though. It was just too depressing. I love the color orange, but this was just a car wash. People said it was like a golden river seen from nearby buildings. No, if you went up those buildings, no, definitely not. It didn't look like a golden river. It looked like dots. It reminded me of the dotted path that Billy would follow on his way home in the family circus. You know, it was just... That also reminded me of the wickets at the Athens Olympic site, right? If you've ever gone there, and the tour guide says on this 100-degree day where you're sweating and you're drinking your Luke Sour cherry drink and you're just melting in the Athens. Basically, Athens is in the sun. The Acropolis is at the center of the sun. I mean that, but anyway. And they're telling you, isn't this great? These arches out here in front of the Olympic site, they provide shelter. They provide shade against the sun. No, there's like one 20 centimeter wide arch every meter or meter and a half. That provides no effective shade. It was just insane. And that's the same thing with the Gates. It did not look like a golden river. Would have been interesting if it did, though, in relation to Vachel Lindsay's Congo poem. But anyway, the point is that in the old centuries, this would have been it. We would have been done. That would have been the end of the story for art in the 20th century. We got what the elites paid for. They set up this amazing symbiotic relationship. But it was the 20th century. This is the century when everybody was rich, right? Deirdre McCloskey, she said, yes, industrialism, yes, capitalism. It allowed Lillian Betancourt to get another yacht. But the poor got to eat. And McCloskey, she's right about that, right? And not only did the poor get to eat, the poor also got art in the 20th century. Everybody could afford art now. Remember, we're in the 21st century now, but I have the same phone in my pocket that Warren Buffett does, right? We watch the same movies. We travel to the same parts of the planet, although his bed might be a little fluffier than mine. His watch doesn't tell time any better than my watch. If he plays video games, we play the same video games, probably, if he has good taste in video games. Watch the same sports. We play the same sports. Everybody's rich now. And so everyone could support art. And so it wasn't, the end of the story was not just the elite supporting Technicolor vomit. It was that the masses were able to support an art market too, a mass market. And the poets and the painters, see, they were wrong to panic. They should not have panicked. These are separate arts, photography versus painting, poetry versus music. And so as the elites staked out their own positions in the positional good market, and as this idea spread from poetry and painting to the other fields like music and architecture, the same thing happened there, right? They saw how successful this relationship was. It conferred status. It drove prices up. And they loved it. So... They modeled the same, or they adopted the same model in other arts. But at the same time that that was happening, the demand was still there for real art. And this is how real art continued, and its value came from art, as opposed to the value coming from position in the positional goods market. The value in art came from actual real art in movie posters and books and comic books. This is how, you know, these days or in those days rather, you could have Maxfield Parrish, right? Maxfield Parrish, very interesting case. He was so fantastically successful as a painter right through this exact period. And by the way, from 1900 to 1902, he was right up here, right in the heart of the ADKs over there at Saranac Lake. I think he was recovering from something at one of their sanatoriums over there. And he continued painting while he was there, though. He was so well supported by the masses, he didn't need to go to the positional goods market. He didn't need to enter into that same sort of relationship with the elite. He was financially insulated. And of course, the demand continued through the decades, right? You had great art being seen in book covers, Frank Fazetta. You have Dragon magazine covers. You have Saturday Evening Post magazine covers, right? Fantastic stuff. That demand for art, for painting, did not go away. Same thing for poetry, right? You had Robert Service. These days you have Insta Poetry. You have Rupi Kaur. You have all these people who are fantastically successful in these markets, the mass market. And that's a wonderful thing. The art has survived. The art is doing just fine. And the positional goods market is doing great too. But the stuff that is on that market does not get its value because of its artistic quality. Despite what anybody will tell you, it only gets its value from its position, from its ability to confer status and to signal. So far, then, we've explained the modernist turn. I've explained the modernist turn, the split in the art market, and the role of the artist and the role of the elite and the role of the masses. We're still leaving out something, though. What about the academy, right? Why did the academy come down almost exclusively on the side of the elite rather than the mass markets? Well, this answer is pretty easy if you know the academy, my friends. The academy, universities, colleges, they have always been about status. It is their lifeblood, prestige, signaling, status. Look at any economics program, right? There's a point where you have to choose. Am I going to the academy or am I going to Wall Street? Status or dollars? Now, of course, there's always some crossover, especially after people have been in career for a long time. But at the beginning of the career, that choice is there. And it points out the contrast between the academy and the market. Of course, the academy is going to poo-poo the market, right? People that have chosen the pressures of politics and political sales over the pressures of production and product sales, they are going to use their political skills to elevate themselves, and they're going to sort of belittle the art in the market. Robert Service, Sarah Teasdale, even Vincent, Edna St. Vincent Millay, eventually were held to be not nearly as valuable as spew like Pound's Cantos or drivel like HD's proto-environmental, proto-second-wave feminist pieces or anything by Paul Muldoon, right? And so that's to be expected because the Academy is about status. They are playing into this elite market, and they are not going to go for the dollars. They've already made that choice by being in the academy. That is their preferred position. I guess I just made a pun there. And everybody knows this, right? It even comes up. Our school invited Jay Asher, right, the author of 13 Reasons Why, to come speak one time. If you believe in the suicide contagion theory, that was a really bad idea, wasn't it? But Jay Asher shows up at our school and he says, well, one of the first things that you learn in the publishing world is there are two ways to be successful. You can sell a lot of books, or you can be a darling of the critics and the Booker Prize world and all of those people, the elites. So, and that was just, you know, a few years ago that he's in our school saying that. And it's true. It matches up to the split market exactly as I've been telling you. You have this market that is traditional and sells based on the quality of art, and the other market that sells based on the status of the piece. So that's it. To recap, right? The modernists turn in art. The reason why we have modern art that sucks so much, it started with poetry and painting. They feared photographs. They feared the recording. So they redefined their arts out of a sense of self-preservation, saying, no, we're not about realism. We're good paintings are really about stuff that can't be seen in any way with a camera, cubism, things like that. And then in poetry, no, we're not about beautiful sounds or song or rhyme or meter. We're actually about images and ideas. And Pound said, right, it's about an intellectual and emotional complex in an instant of time. Oh, that's just silly obfuscation on his part, trying to reserve for himself and his friends the ability to say what is poetry and what isn't poetry. And he'll know it when he sees it, and he'll inform the rest of us, right? It's kind of like a priest that way. He'll know the holy, he'll know the sacred, and only him and his ordained anointed friends, they are the only ones, only he and his ordained anointed friends, they are the only ones who can share that knowledge with us. And they turn to the rich and the elite to support them. And of course, this is just like, you know, the priestcraft class being supported by the kings, and they got monetary support, and the kings got the religious approval, the religious sanction by the priest class. And this is the same sort of relationship that you have between the arts and the elites. The artists were supported by money, and the artists in turn gave the approval of the arts and gave the tool to the rich class, the ability to signal their status, the ability to be an elite club. But it was started by the artists. It was started by the artists. They went to the rich. The rich bought it up from the artists. And then things were different, though, thanks to capitalism from previous centuries. There was also a mass market, and the masses, also the rich too, right? If you go to a billionaire's house, chances are they have a subscription to Netflix. They wanted art for art's sake, and so they got art for art's sake. Sorry, Walter Pater. But this is a very commercial phrase, right? Art for art's sake. MGM has it in their logo around their lion. Commercial artists going way back to Poe, he kind of presaged this. He used this. And of course, the phrase art for art's sake was argued against people by socialists. Socialists did not like the idea of art for art's sake. And who was a socialist? Oh yeah, Ezra Pound supported the National Socialists, the Nazis in Germany. So the artists, in some cases, were able to make a positional goods market from their art, and the quality wasn't given by art. It was determined by the position in the market. And the other art market continued and became the mass market, which is a true art market. And that's what happened with the modernist turn in art. I hope you guys have a great day. I remember to subscribe if you are enjoying the podcast. I'm so new at podcasting that I don't even remind people to subscribe or to like or to comment. But yeah, you should do that because it's good. And we're starting out this podcast and hopefully coming up to great things. I will see you tomorrow, folks. Take care.